The entire company were plunged into mourning when they heard the dire tidings of Taita's disappearance. The next day, when they reloaded the horses and set off again downstream, they went like a procession of funeral barges. Not only had they lost the Magus, but Fen too was gone. Her beauty and winsome ways had been talismans of good fortune to all the company. The younger women, like Sududu, especially those she had set free from the breeding farms, worshipped her. "Though I know it is not true, even I feel bereft without her," Sududu whispered to Merrin. "Why is Taita playing this cruel trick?" "He must make a new life for himself and for Fen. Few of those who knew him when he was ancient and silver-haired will understand his magical transformation. They will see in his rebirth some malevolent act of black witchcraft. He and Fen will become objects of fear and loathing. So they will go to some place where we will not be able to follow them? I cannot comfort you, for I fear that it will be so." He placed his arm round her shoulders. "From here on, you and I must make our own way. We must find strength and purpose in each other." "But what will happen to them? Where will they go?" Sududu persisted. "Taita seeks a wisdom that you and I cannot understand. All his life has been a quest. Now that his life has become eternal, so the quest also." He thought about what he had said, then went on in what was for him a rare flash of insight. "That could be either a great blessing or a great burden." "Will we never set eyes upon them again? Please tell me that it will not be so." "We will see them again before they go. Of that we can be certain. They would never treat us so cruelly. But one day soon they will be gone." While Merrin was speaking, he was watching the near bank as it slid by, looking out for the sign that Taita had promised he would leave. At last he saw a bright prick of light from the bank, a reflection of sunlight off polished metal. He shaded his eyes and peered ahead. "There it is." He steered in towards the bank. The rowers shipped their oars. Merrin jumped the gap between the deck and dry land and ran to the sword that stood on end, its point buried in the earth. He drew it out and brandished it over his head. "Taita's sword," he called to Tinat in the following galley. "This is an omen." Tinat sent a shore party across to him, and they searched the bank for half a league in either direction, but found no further sign of human presence. "Taita is a crafty old fox," Merrin thought. "He has played this charade to such perfection that even I find myself almost taken in by it." He smiled to himself, but kept a sullen mien as he told the men, "It is futile to continue the search. These affairs are beyond our understanding. If Taita the Magus has succumbed, what chance do we stand? We must go back to the flotilla before we ourselves are overwhelmed." They obeyed with alacrity, consumed by superstitious dread and eager to take refuge in the galleys. As soon as all were safely embarked, Merrin gave the order to continue the voyage. The rowers took their seats on the benches and pulled for a league in silence. Hilto was at the stroke oar in the bows. Suddenly he lifted his head and began to sing. His voice was rough but powerful, the voice that had commanded men over the din of battle. It rang out across the silent river. "Hail, thou dread goddess Hagensar, whose years stretch into eternity. Hail, thou who art the keeper of the first pylon. Thou abidest in the utmost parts of the earth. Thou diest each day at the setting of the sun. In the dawn thou art renewed. Each day thou arisest with thy youth renewed as the bloom of the lotus. Taita possesses the words of power. Let him pass the first pylon." It was a chapter from the Book of the Dead, a lament for a king. At once the company took up the chant and sang the refrain. "Let him go where we may not follow. Let him know the mysteries of the dark places. He hath become the wise serpent of the mighty god Horus." Hilto sang the next verse. "Hail, Seth, the destroyer of worlds. Hail, mighty one of our souls, thou divine soul who inspireth great dread. Let the spirit soul of Taita pass the second pylon. He possesses words of power. Let Taita make his way to the lotus throne of Osiris, behind which stand Isis and Hathor." The others came in together, with some of the women singing a descant. Let him go where we may not follow. Let him know the mysteries of the dark places. Let him pass. Let him pass. Standing in the stern of the leading boat, gripping the steering oar, Merrin sang with them. Beside him, Sududu's voice quivered and almost broke under the weight of her emotion as she reached the higher notes. Merrin felt a light touch upon his muscled right arm that rested on the steering oar. He started with surprise and looked about. Nobody was there, yet the touch had been distinct. He had learnt enough while he had been a novice in the service of Taita not to stare directly at the source, so he turned his gaze aside and saw a vague shape appear in the periphery of his vision. When he focused upon it, it disappeared. "Magus, are you there?" he whispered, so that his lips did not move. The voice that answered him was just as airy. "I am with you, and Fen stands beside Sududu." As they had planned, they had come on board while the galley was moored to the bank, at the spot where Taita had planted the sword. Merrin tried not to show his relief and joy in any way that the others might see. He switched his gaze and saw at the opposite edge of his vision another airy shape appear close beside Sududu. "Fen stands at your left hand," he warned Sududu, who looked round in astonishment. "No, you cannot see her. Ask her to touch you." As Sududu felt the brush of Fen's invisible fingers on her cheek, her smile became radiant. When they moored in the late afternoon to set up the zareba on the bank, Merrin addressed the assembled throng. "We will set up a shrine on the foredeck of the leading galley in the place they favoured while they were with us. It'll be a refuge where the spirit souls of Taita and Fen can rest during the 90 days while they are trapped in this plane of existence, the period before they may pass the first pylon on the road to the underworld." They rigged a screen of reed matting around the small space and laid out the sleeping mats and possessions of the missing pair. Each evening Sududu placed an offering of food, beer and water behind it, and by morning they had been consumed. The company was much encouraged to know that the spirit soul of the Magus still watched over them, and the mood in the flotilla lightened. Men smiled and laughed once more, but they kept well clear of the shrine on the foredeck. They came again to Kibui, the place of the north wind, where the river on which they had travelled such an enormous distance joined the other mighty stream rushing down from the mountains in the east to become the true Nile. Kibui had little changed since they had last seen it, except that the irrigated fields surrounding the town were more extensive, the herds of horses and cattle grazed on the green pastures closer to the mud walls of the town. The sudden appearance of a large fleet of strange ships threw the garrison and the townsfolk into consternation and dismay. Only when Merrin showed himself on the prow of the leading vessel and called out his friendly intentions did Governor Nara recognize him. "It is Colonel Merrin Cambyses," he shouted to the captain of his archers. "Do not fire upon them." Nara embraced Merrin warmly as soon as he stepped ashore. "We had long given up hope of your return, so in the name of Pharaoh Nefertiti, we bid you the warmest possible welcome." Nara had never met Tinat. The expedition led by General Lotti had passed through Kibui long before he had assumed the position of governor. Of course he knew of the expedition, and accepted Merrin's explanation of Tinat's status as its surviving commander. But while they were conversing on the river bank, Nara kept looking to the moored boats as though he was expecting someone else to appear. At last he could contain himself no longer, and burst out, "Forgive me, my good colonels, but I must know what has become of the mighty Magus, Taita of Galala, that extraordinary man." "The story I have to tell you is so strange and marvellous as to defy all imagination and belief. But first I must bring all my people ashore and see to their needs. They have been in exile for many years and have made a long, difficult and dangerous journey to reach this outpost of the Empire. As soon as this duty is done, I will make a full and formal report to you, which you will, of course, relay to Pharaoh's court in Karnak." "I beg your forgiveness," Nara's innate good manners reasserted themselves. "I have been wanting in my hospitality. You must bring them ashore at once, then refresh and restore yourselves before I press you further on the story of your travels." That evening in the assembly hall of the fort, Nara held a banquet of welcome for Meron, Tinat and their senior captains. It was also attended by his own staff and the notables of the town. When they had eaten and drunk, Nara rose to address them and made a fulsome speech of welcome. He ended by begging Meron to relate to the assembled guests the story of their sojourn in the foreign lands to the south. "You are the first to return from those mysterious, uncharted regions. Tell us what you discovered there. Tell us if you reached the place where our mother Nile is born. Tell us how it happened that her waters dried up, then came to flow again in such sudden abundance. But tell us, above all, what has become of the Magus, Taita of Galala?" Meron spoke first. He described all that had befallen them since they had last passed that way so long ago. He told them of how they had reached the headwaters of the Nile at Tamafupa and found the red stones impeding the flow of the river. He went on to relate how they had been rescued by Tinat and taken by him to the kingdom of Jari, where they had gone before the Supreme Council of the Oligarchs. "Now I will call upon Colonel Tinat Ankut to relate the fate of the expedition led by General Lord Lotti, how he and his surviving men reached Jari and the conditions they found there." Meron gave the floor to Tinat. As was his style, Tinat's account was terse and without embellishment. In blunt soldier's terms, he described the original establishment of the Jarian government by Lord Aqua in the reign of the Queen Lostris. Then he told of how it had been turned into a ruthless tyranny by the mysterious sorceress Eos. He ended his recitation with the stark statement, "It was this sorceress Eos who used her black magic to erect the rock barrier across the tributaries of the Nile. Her purpose was to subdue Egypt and bring it under her thrall." Pandemonium broke out as the listeners expressed their indignation and shouted questions. Nara jumped to his feet to intervene, but it took him some time to quieten them.
I call upon Colonel Meron to take up the tale again. Please hold your questions until he is finished, for I am sure he will provide the answers to many of your concerns."
Meron was far more eloquent speaker than Tinat, and they listened in fascination as he described how the Magus, Taita of Galala, had entered the stronghold of Eos to confront her. He went alone and unarmed but for his spiritual powers. No one will ever know of the titanic struggle that must have taken place when those two adepts of the mysteries were locked in supernatural conflict. All we know is that at the end Taita triumphed over her. Eos was destroyed and her evil kingdom with her. The barriers she erected across our mother Nile were brought down so that now her waters run again. You have only to look out at the river as it flows past this town of Kwebui to see how it has been revived by Taita's powers. With the help of Colonel Tinat, our people, who had been kept captive in Jari all these years, were released. They sit with you this evening."
"Let them stand forth," Governor Nara cried. "Let us look upon their faces so that we may welcome our brothers and sisters back to our motherland."
One after another, the captains and other officers of Tinat's regiment came to their feet, gave name and rank, then ended with the declaration, "I attest to the truth of all you have heard this evening from our revered leaders, Colonel Meron Cambyses and Colonel Tinat Ankut." When they had finished, Nara spoke again. "We have heard many wonders related this evening, sufficient to fill us with awe. However, I know I speak for all present when I ask one more question that burns in my mind." He paused dramatically. "Tell us, Colonel Cambyses, what has become of the Magus Taita? Why is he no longer at the head of your company?" Meron's expression was solemn. For some time he stood in silence, as though at a loss to explain it. Then he sighed heavily. "It is indeed my most sad and painful duty to have to tell you that the Magus is no longer with us. He has disappeared mysteriously. Colonel Tinat and I have searched diligently for him at the site where he vanished, but to no avail." He paused again, then shook his head. "Although we were unable to find his body, we discovered his clothing and horse. His tunic was stained with his blood, and so was his saddle. We can only attribute his disappearance to some malevolent supernatural occurrence and conclude that the Magus is dead. A groan of despair greeted his words. Governor Nara sat still, his face pale and sad. At last, when the noise in the hall abated and all looked to him, he came to his feet. He began to speak, but his voice failed him. He rallied himself and began again.
These are tragic tidings. Taita of Galala was a mighty man and a good one. I will send the news of his demise to Pharaoh Nefertiti with a heavy heart. In my capacity as governor of the Nome of Kibui, I shall cause to be erected on the banks of the river a monument to the achievement of Taita of Galala in restoring the flow of the life-bringing waters of Mother Nile to us. He was about to say more, but shook his head and turned away. When he left the banquet hall, the guests followed him out in small groups and dispersed into the night. 5 days later, the population of the town and the voyagers from the south assembled again on the spit of land that stood at the confluence of the two branches of the Nile. The monument that Governor Nara had erected there was a column hewn from a single block of blue granite. On it was carved an inscription in beautifully executed hieroglyphics. The masons had worked day and night to have it ready for this day. This stone was erected in the name of Pharaoh Nefertiti in the 26th year of his reign over the two kingdoms, may he be blessed with life eternal. From this point departed the revered Magus Taita of Galala on his historic adventure to reach the headwaters of Mother Nile and to restore the flow of her blessed waters for the benefit of the Egyptian Empire and all its citizens. By virtue of his spiritual power, he succeeded in this dangerous enterprise, may he be praised unstintingly. Tragically, he perished in the wilderness. Although he will never return to our very Egypt, his memory and our gratitude to him, like this granite stela, will abide for 10,000 years. It is I, Nara Tok, governor of the Nome of Kibui, in the name of Pharaoh Nefertiti, the great one beloved of the gods, who have written these words to his praise. Gathered around the granite monument in the early morning sunlight, they sang praises to Horus and Hathor, and beseeched them to take the spirit soul of Taita into their safekeeping. Then Meren and Tinat led the company to the waiting boats. They embarked and set off again in a convoy on the last long leg of the return, another 2,000 leagues, through the 6 great cataracts and into the fertile lands of Egypt. With the Nile running so high, the cataracts were long white shoots of tumultuous water. However, the Jarian boats were designed for precisely these conditions, and Meren was a skilled river pilot. Unseen, Taita stood at his elbow to guide him when he faltered. Between them, they brought the flotilla through without loss or serious damage. Between the 5th and 2nd cataracts, the river meandered out into the western desert in a huge loop that added almost 1,000 leagues to the journey. The relay riders that Governor Nara had sent ahead of them had a lead of 5 days and were able to cut across the bight of the river, taking the direct overland caravan route. The dispatches they carried were read by the governor of the Nome of Aswan many days before the flotilla descended the 1st cataract into the valley of Egypt. From that point on, the voyage became a triumphal progress. On both sides, the land was inundated with the life-bringing water. The peasants had returned to their villages to work the fields, and already their crops were green and flourishing. The population rushed to the banks as the boats sailed past, waving palm fronds. They threw jasmine blossoms into the current to float down with the flotilla. They wept with joy, shouting praise and adulation to the heroes returning from the dark, mysterious southern reaches of the earth. At each city they came to, the travellers were welcomed ashore by the governor, the nobles, and the priests, and led in joyous procession to the temple. They were feasted, fêted, and showered with flower petals. Taita and Fen went ashore with them. Fen was seeing the land she had once ruled for the first time in her present life. No one in Egypt would have recognized either her or Taita in their present form, so Taita dispensed with the spell of concealment behind which they had hidden for so long.
Nevertheless, they covered their faces with their headcloths, so that only their eyes showed and mingled freely with the crowds. Fenn's eyes shone with wonder and joy as she listened to Taita describing and explaining all that she saw about her. Until then, her memories of her other life had been hazy and fragmentary, and even they had been restored to her by Taita. However, now that she stood at last upon the soil of her native land, everything rushed back to her. Faces, words, and deeds from a century before were as clear in her mind as though only a few short years had intervened. At Komombo, they beached the boats below the massive walls of the temple complex. Gigantic images of the gods and goddesses were chiselled into the sandstone blocks. While the High Priestess and her entourage came down to the river bank to welcome the travellers, Taita led Fenn through the deserted corridors of the Temple of Hathor to the dim, cool inner sanctuary. "This is where I first looked upon the image of your spirit soul in your present form," he told her. "Yes, I remember it well," she whispered. "I remember this place so clearly. I remember swimming down to you through the sacred pool. I remember the words we exchanged." She paused as though rehearsing them in her mind before she spoke again. "Fie on you, that you do not know me, for I am Fenn," she repeated, in a sweet childlike treble that wrung his heart. "That was exactly the tone you used," he told her. "Do you recall how you replied to me?" He shook his head. He remembered clearly, but he wanted to hear her say it. "You said," she changed her voice to mimic his, "I knew you all along. You are exactly as you were when first I met you. I could never forget your eyes. They were then and still are the greenest and prettiest in all Egypt." Taita laughed softly. "How like a woman. You never forget a compliment." "Certainly not such a handsome one," she agreed. "I brought you a gift. Do you recall what it was?" "A handful of lime," he answered at once. "A gift beyond price." "You can pay me now. My price is a kiss," she said, "or as many kisses as you deem fair. 10,000 is the figure that springs to my mind." "I accept your offer, my lord. I will take the first 100 at once. The rest you may pay me in increments."